Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're very excited to kick off our brand new year with technology expert Mark Saltzman. Mark attended the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas and has all the details on what you should be looking out for gadget-wise in 2012. We then speak with media personality and columnist Anne Lagasse Dawson about some of the hot topics going on around the world, including the race for the Republican nomination in the U.S. Gina Lee of The Love Zone is here, and we wrap things up with an exciting remix from Katy Perry, The One That Got Away.
Capture your need for sound.
Anyone who is into electronics knows that January is the month for the Consumer Electronics Show, the world's largest consumer technology trade show that features about 2,700 exhibitors. To tell us what we can expect in the world of electronic gadgets this year is syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman, who attended the festivities in Las Vegas. Mark, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Yeah, CES, or Consumer Electronics Show, it was a blast this year. So I'm a little tired. I just got back. There's almost 2 million square feet of showroom space. That's the equivalent of about 35 football fields. So we're talking a lot of stuff to get through. And I know I'm not going to hear any little violins. It was very cool to walk around and get a glimpse at tomorrow's technology today.
And I have to ask you, I guess, because I think a lot of people are wondering where televisions are going, because so many people are always talking now about these interactive television sets.
Without question, the biggest trend at the 2012 Consumer Electronics Show was televisions. That was the focus primarily this year, more so than in previous years. And there's different things that were going on at CES in the television space. To your point, yes, TVs are becoming smarter. So there's a continued evolution between the internet and your television. So you're going to be able to do things like, put like hundreds of apps on your TV screen, much like you might do on your smartphone or tablet. And then every time you click on that app, it does something that's online, like launching YouTube or Twitter or Facebook, or giving you information that you want, playing games. So your big screen TV is basically turning into a computer. And so some interesting things that we saw this year were some voice and gesture support. So instead of using a little keyboard or the remote to access content online, you simply what you want. So you can say, a Google search, and it'll do it based on voice. Or you can say, I feel like watching Family Guy, and it'll launch Family Guy. And gestures are similar to what you can do with the Xbox Kinect, where you use your motions, your arm and hand motions in front of the TV in order to interact with content. So that was pretty cool. There's a new technology called OLED, organic light emitting diodes. And we've seen the biggest OLED TVs this year, 55-inch sets from both Samsung and LG. And these OLED televisions are super thin. We're talking 4 millimeters, not inches, millimeters. And incredible contrast, so very dark blacks and very rich colors. They're more energy efficient. They handle motion very fluidly. So OLED televisions they garnered a lot of the buzz at CES this year, as did something called 4K TV or 8K TV. This is four times or eight times the resolution or the number of dots that make up the image compared to what we call HD today. So Sharp had the world's first 8K television, which is about 8,000 pixels or little dots horizontally by almost 4,000 vertically. So we're talking detail that we've never seen before. So instead of seeing a tree, you're seeing the grain on the bark of the tree. You're seeing thin fibers on the leaves, on the branches, on the tree. It's like peering out of a window.
Wow.
So that was very cool. So some companies like Sharp and Samsung and LG, they had 4K TVs, which looked phenomenal. And then there was Sharp that had the world's first 8K TV. It was an 85-incher. And just the quality, you need an 8K camera that can shoot that high definition in order to see it, of course. But it's just a glimpse as to where it's going.
Now, if someone is in the market for a television this year, do they actually get one this year, Mark, or do they wait for 2013?
Well, the good news about what's happening these days, and if, you know, leading up to the holidays and Boxing Week was any indication in Canada, that prices are at an all-time low. You're able to get a lot of bang for your buck. We're talking 50-inch TVs for, you know, $500. So that's a great trend, just because prices are coming down. There's increased competition. Companies are able to maximize their manufacturing methods. So that's all good news. The Consumer Electronics Show is more future, you know, looking into the future, peering into what we're going to be using in a few years from now. So I wouldn't advise anybody to save up for a 4K TV or an OLED TV, because we're still a few years away from mainstream adoption there. You know, both Samsung and LG said 4K, sort of their OLED TVs will come out this year, but they're going to be priced at a very high premium, probably around $10,000 or more for a 55-inch OLED television. I wouldn't be surprised if it was double that. But in any event, so to answer your question a little bit more directly, I think it's a great time to buy a TV if you're waiting to, because the prices are so aggressively low and they're packed with features. But if you want to wait for some of the things that we saw at the Consumer Electronics Show this week in Vegas, you know, you're going to be waiting for a while.
Okay. And a quick question for you. Are PVRs like still important heading through 2012?
I don't think there was anything new with PVRs or personal video recorders. They're also referred to as DVRs in the U.S., digital video recorders. And that's basically just the ability to record a lot of content onto a hard drive that's connected to your television that you can call up on demand. Some of the things that we did see at CES, Dish was there from the U.S., formerly known as Dish Network, and they unveiled a new DVR with, you know, thousands of hours of content you can store. And then another trend is the ability to access that content remotely. So not only do you, of course, have access to all of your recorded programming or in front of your TV, but if you have an app on your smartphone or tablet and you're away from the home over the internet or, you know, Wi-Fi or cellular connectivity, you're going to be able to tap into your PVR at home and access that content as if you were sitting in front of the TV at home. You've been only able to do that in the past through things like the Slingbox product, which is a little box that you connect to your programming, your cable or satellite box. Or in some cases, there are apps from the likes of Bell and Rogers and Telus and Shaw that let you tap into it. But it hasn't been very graceful, and that's where I think things are changing. The big overall trend is that you're going to be able to access all of your content, no matter where you are in the world, regardless of what device you're on. That's where we're all inching towards.
And about tablets, I wanted to ask you that. Did you see a lot of new or at least improved tablets? And part two of that question is, you know, is there any reason to buy an e-reader, or should you just be saving up to buy a tablet?
Okay, so good questions there. I'm going to answer your second one first, and that is, if you want to buy an e-book reader, should you just buy a tablet? Well, the answer to that is, if you only want to buy something to read books on, then save yourself the cash and just buy an ebook reader for $100. If you want a color computer that is flat like an ebook reader, then, and you want things like watching videos and surfing the web and reading your email and playing games, if you want more of a richer experience, then you're going to want to pay three or four times that cost and get a tablet, which they also make for decent ebook readers as well. Battery life isn't as good on a tablet as it is on an ebook reader. An ebook reader can last a month between charges, and they have a screen doesn't give you any glare. You can read it outside. But tablets do have a bit of glare, something to keep in mind. At CES, at the Consumer Electronics Show this week in Vegas, there surprisingly wasn't a lot of tablets. That was all the rage last year at the 2011 Consumer Electronics Show, as many companies were trying to take a bite out of Apple's success with the iPad. Most failed. So I think what happened this year is that we did see some tablets. There was an interesting one from Toshiba, and Lenovo, a Chinese manufacturer, had a cool tablet prototype. But I still think they were just trying to show off a few innovative things. But there really wasn't a lot of buzz about tablets. And I think many are just conceding that space to Apple. Nobody can touch the iPad at this point. So that was, that was an interesting observation, that there weren't a lot of tablets this year. But if you think about it, it makes sense.
Joining us on the show this week is syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman from Toronto. Mark, what's actually happening in the world of laptops? Because it seems everyone is all about these teeny tiny laptops like, you know, the AirBook.
That's right. So one of the biggest trends right now, and certainly CES had a lot of them, and they're called Ultrabooks. So these are, much like you were saying, they're kind of copying it with the MacBook Air. These are very thin and lightweight laptops, but they have a lot of power. So previously, if you wanted to go small with a laptop, they were a netbook. They were, you know, entry-level price or a couple hundred dollars. Really, you couldn't do a lot with them. You can surf the internet, and that's about it. But the good thing about Ultrabooks is that you're not sacrificing power to have the smaller size. So they're typically, you know, 13-inch screens and bigger, but only a few millimeters thin. And they also don't have a hard drive. They use flash memory, similar to what's in your camera. It's called SSD or solid state drives. And while you don't have as much capacity, you can't fit as many files on these Ultrabooks as you can a hard drive. Because they use flash memory with no moving parts, they boot up a lot faster. So you're only waiting a couple of seconds to boot up your computer. You have longer battery life, 8 to 10 hours. They deliver faster performance when you're opening up programs and running them. They're also more durable because there's no moving parts. They're less prone to damage. So Ultrabooks are sort of this new class of laptops that you're going to hear a lot more about in 2012. And there's a lot of companies that had Ultrabooks at the show.
And is there anything to be excited about desktop-wise?
No, not really. You know, a stationary computer has its advantages. They're less prone to damage because you can't drop them as easily because they're not portable. Good for younger kids, so you can keep an eye on where they're going online. You know, you want to put it in a trafficked area of the home. But because laptops give you portability and wireless connectivity without with getting close to the power of a desktop, most people go with a laptop because then you can move around your home, you can bring it outside of your home, and you still remain connected to the internet without having to be plugged into the wall. So the only thing that's really, and it's not even really new, but the latest thing to happen to desktops a couple of years ago is adding touch. So they're folding the computer inside of the monitor itself. And while you get a wireless mouse and keyboard with it, you're using your fingertip on the screen, much like a tablet, in order to interact with the content. Or if you want, you can go to a keyboard and mouse if you're doing some schoolwork and you want to type a long book report or something.
Okay.
But no, there was nothing I saw that was spectacular at the Consumer Electronics Show. I think what happened a few years ago was that laptops eclipsed desktop sales. It eclipsed desktop sales. So more people are buying laptops. And then soon tablets and Ultrabooks are going to eclipse laptop sales.
Okay. And I have to ask this because I know you enjoy the games. So for gamers out there, what systems are hot tickets this year?
Okay. So this week at the Consumer Electronics Show, I got my hands on the new PlayStation Vita or PS Vita. This is a handheld gaming system that's coming out on February 22nd for $249 for the Wi-Fi version. And it's essentially a dedicated gaming device. You can do some other things too, like go on your social networks and listen to music, but it's meant for gamers and it delivers console-like graphics. So the kind of visuals that you would expect from your TV, these sort of really high-end video games that are photorealistic, you can now get on a portable system for the first time. So this isn't Angry Birds. This isn't like, you know, a kind of cartoony like gaming system. This is portable power. And there is a huge segment of the gaming population that wants something that. Plus, you even have controls that are like a video game system for your TV, including what are called analog sticks. So there's dual analog sticks. There's these two things that stick out of the PS Vita on each side of the screen, and you lay your thumbs on them, and then you rock them around to control the character or the environment. So PS Vita was exciting. Then the other big thing for gamers at CES this week was Nintendo gave some journalists some hands-on time with their upcoming gaming system for the home, coming out later this year, called the Nintendo Wii U. Capital U as in university. And this is, it will be backward compatible, so it'll play existing Nintendo Wii games, but it uses a tablet-like controller to control the action. So on your lap, you have this, I believe it's a 6-inch touchscreen. It also has some buttons on it too. But you actually can use this to tilt it around or press on the buttons to control what you're seeing on your TV screen, but then you're also seeing something on the tablet as well. So, for example, you're playing a football game against your sibling. You don't want them to see what plays you're choosing. You can draw those plays with your fingertip on your tablet screen, and so does your sibling, and you can't see what each other is choosing, which play to execute in the football game, you know, where previously that information would be on the big screen and you're sharing it. So it's a clever idea, and Nintendo also showed that at CES this year.
I'm glad you clarified that, because I watched a video of the Wii U, and I guess the one that I was watching was Zelda or something, so I couldn't understand what the point of the little tablet is. But now that you've explained it, that it's more of a personal thing, so that not all your tricks or whatever you want to call it are on screen for everyone else to see. So that's cool.
Yeah, that's one application for it. Another application is, say you're playing this fantasy role-playing game and you're venturing in this, you know, this dungeon or in this town, in a medieval-like town, you can be watching the TV screen for the majority of the action, but when you want to see where you are on your map, previously you had to get out of the game and open up a second screen that showed your map and where you are in the world. But now you can just glance down at your controller and you have that second screen there that can give you, you know, ancillary information. So it's pretty cool. It's you know, I think Nintendo is thinking outside the box again. They're kind of fusing an iPad-like controller with the Nintendo system, and you know, it was a lot of fun to play this week.
And I have to ask you too, Mark, was there anything that was, you know, standout accessories for tablets or you know, game devices that sort of caught your eye that people might want to look out for?
Sure. I mean, if you already own a smartphone or a tablet, there's no shortage of accessories out there. So we saw all kinds this week. A lot of them, you know, because the economy in the U.S. isn't as strong as it usually is, I don't think a lot of companies took chances on really strange or really, you know, really out there accessories. We did see things like remote control helicopters that you would use app for, so you'd control the action on your smartphone, but you're actually moving around in a helicopter. We saw all kinds of cases. We saw wireless speakers. So instead of having to dock your iPhone into a speaker in order to hear the music, you can wirelessly play to a nearby speaker. Things like that. But I don't think there's anything outrageous. You know, there's the headphone, the Monster and the Dr. Dre headphones have been popular for a couple of years. So many other famous rappers and hip hoppers are lending their name to a new set of headphones. So we're seeing that as well. And there were some celebrity sightings at CES on that note. There was John Bieber and Justin Timberlake and 50 Cent and, you know, Ludacris and, you know, the Tom Hanks. So it does bring in some star power as well.
And before I let you go, Mark, last thing, what would you want to leave my listeners with as overall things to look out for this year if they're, you know, in the market and have extra cash to spend?
If you haven't upgraded to a smartphone, there's going to be more and more options out there. Some really cool phones that are essentially computers for your pocket. So for those who are waiting, there's going to be a lot of new ones, most of them using the Android operating system, some using Windows as well, the Windows Phone platform. And there will likely be an iPhone 5 this year as well, even though Apple doesn't partake officially in the Consumer Electronics Show. And same with tablets. And you know, ebook readers are very inexpensive because you can get the books much cheaper. In fact, a lot of the ebook readers let you rent books digitally from your local library. So you need to spend the $100 or $120 for the device itself, but then buying books is going to be cheaper because you're doing it digitally, if free. So definitely, you know, whatever you're into, if it's books or music or movies, there is something in the technology world that'll help you enhance and enrich that experience.
Mark, thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
That's Mark Saltzman, a syndicated technology columnist from Toronto. Make sure to check him out on Twitter, twitter.com/Mark_Saltzman.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee, and today we're talking about chemistry. When it comes to dating, one of the top qualities we look for is chemistry. And what exactly is chemistry? It's that electric charge you get when you're in their presence, that irresistible pull when you hear their voice, see their face, even when you smell them. And that's really the chemical part of chemistry. There are real physiological factors at play, which we have no control over. Scientists have proven that our bodies release very potent chemical signals called pheromones. And while you won't be able to smell them, they can have a very profound effect on you. You ever felt physically drawn to someone for some inexplicable reason? That's chemistry. And for many, it's an essential component of true love. It's important to not confuse chemistry with compatibility. Just because you both have a lot in common doesn't mean you'll have chemistry together. It certainly increases the chances, but it's not a guarantee. The fact that you both like the same music, working out, and watching kung fu movies won't automatically translate into a match made in heaven, but it could make for a good friendship. And that's the line that chemistry draws in the sand between the love zone and the dreaded friend zone. We've all been there, not able to make a relationship out of a friendship because you're just not that into them. The chemicals needed to create that spark is simply not there. So how can you tell whether you have chemistry with someone? It usually happens within the first 10 seconds. But if you don't feel it in that moment, it's still possible for it to develop as time goes on. As you get to know and become more comfortable with each other, you'll start to sense more than you did before. Common physical signs that chemistry is taking hold is when in their presence you feel weak in the knees and have a rush of excitement that can cause your heart to race and your palms to sweat. You might find yourself wanting to be as close to them as possible, perhaps to get a deeper whiff of those intoxicating pheromones. Now, just as compatibility is not enough to create chemistry, the reverse is true. Just because you're feeling chemistry with someone doesn't mean you'll be good together as a couple. Sometimes all you have is chemistry, but everything else in your lives doesn't gel, and that could spell trouble down the line. It's a particular kind of hell having amazing chemistry with someone you're not compatible with. You're like a moth to a flame, knowing you're doomed but unable to resist the heat. These are the encounters that inspire countless love songs and romantic movies. These are the relationships that you sometimes regret but never forget. So it seems that the best bet is to find someone who you're compatible and have chemistry with. Easier said than done, isn't it? You may have to make a compromise as to how much of each you're willing to have in a relationship. While chemistry is the more alluring quality, being swept off your feet and onto cloud nine, compatibility is what you need to make a relationship last. Or maybe it's the other way around. No matter how compatible you are, if you don't feel that electric charge when you're with them, then you're not much more than intimate friends, aren't you? Maybe it varies day by day. Sometimes it's compatibility that gets you through the hard times and chemistry that makes it worth going through. I guess all we can do is follow our heart and our pheromones.
Time.
There is no shortage of important stories and current events going on around the world. To talk about what's trending now is media personality, columnist of Bloke Nation in the Hour, hour.ca, as well as president and director general of the Tolerance Foundation in Montreal, Anne Lagasse Dowson. And welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, Kelly, how are you?
I am fantastic. And one of the big stories that, you know, only continues to heat up, Anne, is the race for the Republican nomination in the United States. I think it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride the last few months with several, you know, contenders rising to the top. And then they seem to dip, you know, pretty low, including Texas Governor Rick Perry, not to mention businessman Herman Cain. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, he seems to be sort of leading the pack right now. And is he the best person out of the bunch?
Well, I tell you, I don't have an opinion on who the best person in that bunch is because I'm not too partial to any of them particularly. And I find the fact that Mitt Romney has come to the top sort of interesting because this is a guy who is now being attacked by, among others, Newt Gingrich, who was leading the pack there for a while. Gingrich has used a really interesting method of attacking Romney. He's had a documentary film made, right? A half an hour long documentary film sort of profiling Mitt Romney. I think you can see parts of it on YouTube. But basically, he does a real hatchet job on Romney because Romney brags about how successful he's been in business, right? Well, Romney's business has been putting the axe to businesses, like saving or allegedly saving businesses by laying off, slashing, cutting. I mean, he's kind of like a predatory businessman, and that's how he's made his own personal fortune. And so Gingrich has attacked him very effectively using this documentary film. I mean, Romney, we also know, is a practicing Mormon. Mormons that I know tell me that it's very unlikely that he's doing anything in his political life without taking advice from the Mormon Church. He's flip-flopped on all kinds of issues. He went from being sort of socially liberal on issues like abortion and gay marriage to becoming a hardcore right-wing guy. So, you know, it just seems like, you know, he has one set of principles, and if those ones seem to be too successful, he just changes. If you don't like those ideas, here, I've got another bunch for you. So I don't know. He's also kind of adopted a lot of the Tea Party's ideas. So I don't have a favorite in that slate of candidates. I must say, Ron Paul looks like the least offensive to me at this point.
Okay. And do you think there is a dark horse? Is he the dark horse, this Ron Paul guy? Do you think he can actually do anything?
Well, I don't know if he's a dark horse. He's an interesting character because he's very sort of close to the U.S. public opinion on issues like military intervention and on the economy, he strikes me as being a bit crackpotty, but he seems like a serious guy. I don't know. I think that the Republican Party has really come on hard times in the U.S.
And I want to ask you as well, just because you don't sound very enthused by this group of Republicans.
No, that would be putting it mildly, yeah.
So yeah. Overall, though, if you were a Republican, if you can just put yourself in those shoes for a moment, would you be, as a Republican, disappointed in the group that you have to choose from?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think what's happened is the Tea Party has sucked up all the oxygen and everybody's falling all over themselves to sound like a Tea Party type of guy. And, you know, the Republican Party has not always been kind of a crack party part of the party of the right. There have been also, in the past anyway, there have been some really good or, you know, sort of reasonably oriented sort of centrist candidates. And that doesn't seem to be what's going on with the Republicans. It seems like, you know, they opened a Pandora's box when they let the Tea Party sort of in, and now nobody knows how to shut it down. Even David Frum, who wrote speeches for the Bushes, the Canadian conservative, David Frum is starting to look really slightly alarmed at what's going on with the Republican leadership race.
And, you know, let's just say that Mitt Romney gets the nomination. Do you think he will pick anyone from the bunch to be his running mate?
That's a really good question. I wonder if it wouldn't be Perry. I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I think he's sort of gotten a bit in his teeth, and it remains to be seen. I mean, he was very interesting during a couple of the debates that I saw. I'm not too sure who he would line up with.
Were you surprised how ridiculous Rick Perry has gone? Like, he started off so strong and then a couple of missteps, and he seems to be not in the basement, but pretty close.
Yeah. No, that did surprise me. He struck me as being pretty personable. But, I think it's just this atmosphere of complete attack politics that has taken over so that nobody's talking about any real ideas, anything concrete about the economy. There's this adulation of wealthy people. Any of these guys, all these campaigns cost millions upon millions of dollars to run, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing has just become completely distorted. I have to say we in Canada, despite the problems we have, you know, are doing much better in terms of our electoral politics. The participation rates, relative costs are lower. Like, we have a better range of candidates. I think we're very fortunate. We should, you know, remember that when we see what kind of the circus that has become the Republican leadership race.
And do you think that because of this group of Republicans, that is, it is not, you know, they're not the hot stars, I guess, as I'll put it. Do you think this is going to help Obama maybe lock up a second term?
Yeah. I'm sure Obama is looking at that and thinking, well, that, you know, that's going to be super helpful to him, because compared to those guys, Obama looks like, you know, he is the voice of reason. You know, I think it's very good for the Democrats in that sense, but it's bad for politics because some of the stuff is so absurd and so over the top that I think it's going to push more people away from the political process. And I mean, we just saw the economy almost tank. We just saw those guys from Goldman Sachs come out of the tanking of the economy virtually unscathed. So we see the gap between the 1% and the 99% growing dramatically. And I think it's really bad for the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has now got a rate of inequality that is growing like at staggering rates, right? Like there are lots more poor people in the U.S. than there ever have been. And I think it's really too bad for the American people.
Joining us on the show right now is Anne Lagasse-Dowson, media personality, columnist of Bloke Nation in the Hour, hour.ca. She's also president and director general of the Tolerance Foundation in Montreal. You can check it out, www.fondationtolerance.com. Now, Anne, if I switch gears a little bit here, recently Dutch native Joren van der Sloot was sentenced by a Peruvian court to 28 years in prison for the murder of business student Stephanie Flores back in 2010. Van der Sloot, by the way, has long been, you know, in the news for the disappearance of American high school student Natalie Holloway, who disappeared back in 2005 in Aruba on a school trip. Her body so far not found. And do you think that the punishment for this crime against Stephanie's murder, or for Stephanie's murder, the 28 years, is that enough for this guy?
I think so. I mean, you know, that's basically life, or pretty close to it. I mean, I guess he's in his mid-20s, but that's a good long sentence. I know the family wishes that, you know, would like to have seen a more severe sentence. But I think, you know, 30 years is basically what we call life in Canada. That's a serious bite out of a person's life. This guy, though, I must say, he's a big guy. I watched some of the video of him. He's over 6 feet tall. He was a competitive tennis player. He lived the life of an extremely privileged person in Aruba. He comes from a very elite family. He's a very hard guy to like, I have to say. At one point, you saw him yawning during his own trial. I mean, really, yawning while your life is potentially being completely altered. That being said, he's staying in a horrible prison in eastern Lima, called the Castro prison. It's very rough, right? And apparently he's received death threats from the prison population. This is like the latest celebrity crime, you know, circus. Like this is sort of right after Michael Jackson, we end up talking about van der Sloot. Mm-hmm. But this is a guy that really seems to have some serious personality problems, right? Even his mother has refused to visit him. His mom told reporters that she figures he suffers from mental problems and that he should suffer the consequences for committing the Flores murder. The lawyers are saying they were going to try for an insanity plea. I don't know. I mean, I think this seems like a reasonable sentence given what we know about this guy and his history.
And, you know, no one's been able to nail him for Natalie's disappearance, even though, you know, he was arrested twice in that case. Knowing what we know now about him murdering, you know, Stephanie Flores, is there any doubt in your mind that he had something to do with Natalie's disappearance and, you know, obviously her death, it seems to be?
It looks like something very bad went down that night when he left the bar with her and two of his buddies. He even tried to extort the family, the Holloway family, for money in return for information about where her body was. So he just seems like a psychopath. Holloway's body was never found. And there was never enough definitive evidence. There was circumstantial evidence, but never enough definitive evidence to really get him on that first incident. So, it looks probable, highly probable even, but, mm-hmm. you know, since there's been no body, it's very difficult to really to pin that one down.
Okay. Now, I have to talk to you about media mogul, you know, Oprah Winfrey. She just celebrated the inaugural graduation of her students from the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls in South Africa. The school has undergone, you know, a fair amount of turbulence, I would say, to get to this point, including, you know, administration issues. And then there was that whole investigation over sexual abuse. Is this a turning point for Oprah in the fact that they were able to overcome the hurdles and get, you know, these 72 young ladies to graduate and actually be accepted? I believe all of them have been accepted to university.
I think that this is, like, well-motivated. Like, this is sort of my complaint about Oprah, is that she comes from, you know, she's come from a long ways away. She's, you know, did incredible work with television talking about issues that a lot of people care about. But I'm not too sure how much good she's actually really done in concrete terms. So this is something that she really tried to pull off, right? Like, she spent $40 million setting up this really elite school. It's called the Leadership Academy for Girls. There were some scandals, as you mentioned. There was a dortoir. There was somebody who was accused of sexually abusing the students. There was actually one of the girls got pregnant, and the fetus was found dead in the school. I mean, there's been, you know, but she plucked these kids out of, you know, dire poverty, 72 of them, gave them excellent quality education. I mean, this is a really luxurious school. They even had a hairdresser on the premises.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
One of the students was quoted as saying they were treated like princesses at this school. The thing is, I'm not convinced. You know, like, I'm a big supporter of public education. It seems to me that the best thing would have been to teach as many young girls, especially, to read, because all the research on fighting poverty in these kinds of contexts shows that if you teach people to read, especially the girls and the women, suddenly the birth rates drop down to manageable levels. The families pull themselves up really rapidly once, you know, the women are empowered to be able to learn to read and to, you know, get some kind of work and accumulate a small amount of money. The whole environment around a family suddenly gets lifted up. And it seems to me that taking 72 kids, lavishing them with all kinds of privilege and luxury and trying to make them into leaders is skipping a few steps. It would be far better, it seems to me, to improve the sort of basic level of the quality of life and literacy for a great many more people at once than to do it in this kind of elite way. And that's sort of what complaint that I have about Oprah, is that she's sort of, I don't know, she seems to have lost touch with what's actually going on in terms of the grassroots. Like, why treat 72 of them like princesses? Why not treat several thousands of these kids to proper schools and safe water and that kind of stuff? For $40 million, you can do a lot in a place like South Africa.
And do you think, speaking of South Africa, that she's kind of missed the boat a little bit and should have been doing this closer to home?
Well, and there's also, that is a very good point. Like, we just talked about the Republican political race. Like, there are all kinds of people in the U.S. who are living in their cars, right? Like, 2 years ago at the opening of school, 1 million kids showed up for school and with no address. The schools could not send them or their parents correspondence by the mails because they didn't live anywhere. People are sleeping in their vans and cars in Walmart parking lots across the U.S. You know, there's a serious problem with major poverty and unemployment in the U.S. So, you know, I'm not too sure why. I guess she was sort of in love with the mythology around Nelson Mandela. It seems to me that she's not really thinking in a kind of rigorous way about what is the best way to tackle some of these social issues. That being said, at least she's tried. Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that it's too elitist and it's too focused on appearances. And I'm just sorry that more people can't benefit from this kind of largesse. This also goes to the point of how charity, which is, you know, administered by one person in their own image, doesn't do as good a job as really good public programs like systematic public education, access to bursaries and loans, and, you know, proper high schools and colleges and that kind of stuff. That does a much better job across the board than a couple of charitable projects like this.
Do you think, in the way that she has done this, to some level, she has created a successful model, though, for other philanthropists maybe to follow in regards to creating schools for the disadvantaged and making it work? Or she kind of was, like you said, it was too much to go with just 72. She should have been doing it for thousands of people.
Well, I'm not a big fan of philanthropy for this kind of stuff. I think what needs to be, what has to be done is poverty has to be tackled using the good old-fashioned tools we know that work. Raising the literacy levels, educating the women, providing them with access to birth control education, putting in public programs, safe water supplies, building roads, this kind of stuff, right? Like, these kinds of things we know are proven formulas that work. And so one shiny example of a super fancy school like that is all well and good, but it's not going to do enough for the majority of the population. That, let's just hope that, you know, some of those 72 women that did really well, these young women at Oprah's school, will, you know, keep that in their minds. And when they go back to South Africa after they graduate from their college degrees elsewhere, we'll try and introduce some of these massive social reforms, because that's what, you know, that's what made Canada into the country it is now. It's not philanthropy. It was public programs. The same with the United States. But what we're seeing is all these kinds of public programs are being rolled back in favor of these kinds of philanthropic projects. And I don't think they do enough for the common people.
Okay. On the show is Anne Lagasse-Dowson, media personality, columnist of Bloke Nation in the Hour, hour.ca, also president and director general of the Tolerance Foundation here in Montreal. You can check it out, www.fondationtolerance.com. And something that struck me in the news, actually, is that Queen Elizabeth, you know, she's celebrating her Diamond Jubilee this year. And apparently an idea was proposed to buy her a new royal yacht to mark the occasion. Now, British Prime Minister David Cameron quickly, you know, shot down this idea, especially, you know, of the idea of using taxpayer money in these, you know, difficult economic times, to say the least. But do you think any public money should be spent on the Queen in celebration of her 60 years, you know, in charge of the throne or on the throne? Or should any celebrations be funded privately?
Listen, the Queen of the British Empire, the Queen of England, is one of the wealthiest people in the world, right? I mean, she has apparently under one of her palaces a storage room of her collection of jewels, which is as big as a football field. So I would say maybe she should sell one or two of her tiaras and finance it herself. I don't really care to see her in Canada coming to celebrate her Diamond Jubilee next summer as planned by Stephen Harper, right? Like, this is... The royals, to me, are sort of anachronism. I don't really think you can knock them out of the Constitution, because it's sort of better to leave the constitutional dogs lying, right? Like, you know, we don't necessarily want to revive the constitutional debate. But I don't think we should spend a lot of money on these people. Like, I was a bit shocked when Kate and what's his name?
Prince William.
Yeah, came to Canada during the summer. I guess they had a sort of young, fresh celebrity appeal, and they're kind of cute and whatever. But, I mean... It's so irrelevant, it seems to me, to modern life. And I, you know, in Sweden, the royal family drives their own cars and they occupy a sort of a very benign role, and they just sort of go about their business, and they don't live that much more high on the hog than the rest of the population, from what I understand. I don't really get this thing with the royals, and I'm absolutely opposed to spending any extra money on these people. I mean, you know, the myth is that Charles used to have somebody to brush his teeth. And when the royals came to Canada in 1970, they had one person whose job it was to carry around the royal toilet seat cover, which was made out of unborn lambskin.
Oh my,
I mean,
God.
What has this got to do with anything? It's absolutely ridiculous.
Wow. So I'm assuming then that, I don't, you know, like you said, you want to let the constitutional dogs lie. But if we do speak about the monarchy in general, do you wish that they were sort of gone, if it wasn't a big deal to get rid of them?
Well, yeah. I mean, what have they got to do with, you know, this is like some relic of the ancient past. I mean, Canada is a modern electoral functioning democracy, which really has nothing to do with any of this stuff. But this, if I can just introduce a small political point, though, the Stephen Harper government is very big on rebranding Canada, getting rid of all the old Liberal brand and the ideas associated with it, right? The Liberal brand would have been peacekeeping and the blue helmets, the blue berets, the Nobel Prize for peacekeeping, multiculturalism, official bilingualism, you know, that stuff. The Conservatives want to get rid of all that stuff and rebrand the country as a country that loves the royals, that puts royal in front of everything, that, you know, venerates hockey and is massively in favor of military interventions and military culture. Well, I'm not too sure that that's an accurate representation of the country, but that's a big part of what the Conservative government is trying to do right now. And the royals are a big part of it. Stephen Harper and his family are sort of obsessed with military history and British military history specifically. So we're all being, handed a diet of this stuff.
Do you think, actually, just because you brought up Stephen Harper, do you think that the reason, or part of the reason why he's going this route, is because he's really not that cool? Like, I... Like, I'm wondering if it's like he feels like he's always the bridesmaid and never the bride. Like, I know he is the bride because he is, you know, our prime minister. But I really, he is so non-rock star-ish to me as a leader.
He's a kind of a policy wonk, I guess. But I mean, he actually, you know what's sort of funny is the guy who does the cartoons for La Presse, Serge Chapleau, who's really talented, keeps making drawings of Stephen Harper and trying to make him look more and more like the Queen, like physically like the Queen. So, you know, I guess the next thing you'll know, he'll be wearing funny hats. But, Yeah, I guess he's not the coolest guy. I don't think an effective politician has to be cool. But I'm having a hard time liking this royal thing. You know, like they reintroduced royal to the Air Force, the Canadian Air Force, is called the Royal Canadian Air Force again. After they took it out, he's put it back in. You know, they put up portraits of the Queen in government offices across Canada and around the world. I mean, it just seems to be like a giant step backward.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there for this week. But Anne, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
It's fun. Take care.
Excellent. That is Anne Lagasse-Dowson, again, media personality, columnist of Bloke Nation in the Hour, hour.ca, as well as president and director general of the Tolerance Foundation here in Montreal, www.fondationtolerance.com.
Capture your need for sound.
A recent tragedy that has captured the world's attention is the collision and partial sinking of the massive cruise ship Costa Concordia off the island of Giglio in Italy. Now, over 4,200 passengers and crew had to abandon ship in a very haphazard manner, to say the least. It sounds like no one took charge of the evacuation, including the captain, Captain Francesco Schettino, who, along with, it sounds like, several of his first officers, abandoned ship before all of the passengers were off. They somehow managed to get into a rescue vessel and left the ship and refused to return, apparently, even though the Port Authority ordered the captain to return to ship to handle the evacuation. And he said something to the effect of, it's dark and we can't see anything and the ship is listing. And as you and I both know, one of the cardinal rules of being a captain is that you do not leave the ship until all of your passengers are off. And if the situation warrants, you go down with the ship. Again, if your passengers are not all off, you do not leave them there. That is part of your job as being captain of a ship. So the disaster, and that's what we're going to call it, because there are several people that have passed away, more than 10. There are many people still unaccounted for. And the ship, as of now, is still listing on its side off this reef, again, off of Italy. There's going to have to be a massive cleanup operation, I guess, if you call it that. So far, there hasn't been any telltale signs of leaking of oil or fuel, but they're going to have to deal with trying to get all this oil off the ship as well as all the fuel. Apparently, there were 17 tanks of fuel that need to be emptied, so that's going to be quite the process. Not to mention, again, there's still people that are unaccounted for, and a lot of these rescue officers have been doing, you know, their best to try to get into various compartments of the ship to try to find people. It's not looking good right now that they're going to find any more survivors, but they are trying to at least see if there are survivors and then account for the missing. And I actually read a story from one couple, a couple from Calgary, Canada, who were on the ship, and they said it was absolute pandemonium when the incident happened aboard the ship. They had just finished eating their appetizers, and then there was this jolting collision that they felt, and plates were flying, and everything just started to go badly from that point on. And they said that it was complete pandemonium. People were pushing children out of the way. It was a very dangerous situation, and they made the decision to make sure that they stuck together. Again, they are a married couple, Lawrence and Andrea Davis of Calgary, and they actually ended up, it sounds like, jumping off the fourth floor of the ship and into the water, and then they had to swim 150 meters to shore. And they said it was the most horrific experience that they've ever gone through. So as you can imagine, that is one couple. There are several more, obviously, thousands more people that had to abandon ship in a haphazard manner, to say the least, to try to save their lives. And as I was thinking about this tragedy again, it has captured the world's attention. There was so many nations involved because there are so many passengers from many countries around the world that were on the ship. So a lot of countries are very interested in the situation because they had citizens aboard this cruise ship that went down. And just sort of reading all the news reports out of everything, I guess the one thing that strikes me the most, you know, a lot of people think that going on cruises around the world or cruises in the Caribbean is a very fun thing to do. And I totally agree with that. I think, you know, most of these ships are in tip-top shape, as this one was. It sounds like, by all accounts, that it was error on the part of the ship's management to take this course that ended up having them hit this rock in this reef, which then caused the ship to sink. But I think the thing that stands out to me the most is that I don't know how serious the passengers themselves or even the ship's crew, teach them how to abandon ship and deal with rescue vessels and how to get off the ship as much as possible into lifeboats. I think people take for granted that it's this massive ship and they probably feel like they're on a floating city and that nothing bad can happen aboard one of these, you know, flying cruisers is basically what it is. It's these massive ships that are, you know, bigger than football fields. So I think that the industry, the cruise industry is going to have to take a hard look at their security measures and making sure that passengers are very well aware of how to get off the ship, that life rafts will work even if the ship is listing, and that, you know, above all else, I guess, that the crew remains in charge, that they actually practice their drills and do what needs to be done to take care of the passengers, because that is part of their job. That is what they've signed up for. So my thoughts and prayers going out to anyone who had family or friends aboard the Costa Concordia. Hopefully they did remain safe. And again, I think everyone here and around the world watching this tragedy feels very bad for people who are on their vacation and who may have passed away in this this serious event.
Bring on the... Remix.
Summer after high school when we first met, when they got in your Mustang to Radiohead, and on my 18th birthday we got matching tattoos. Used to steal your parents' liquor and climb to the roof, talk about our future like we had a clue. Never been a one day
with The One That Got Away, remixed by Tommy Sunshine and Disco Fries on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, including Mark Saltzman, Anne Lagasse Dowson, and Gina Lee of The Love Zone for being on the show. And I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Nelson Mandela. There is no passion to be found playing small in settling for a life that is less than the one that you are capable of living. There you go. Don't forget to keep checking out our webpage for new blogs and poll questions, kellyalexandershow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.